You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Part of the stated mission of National Public Radio is to present fair, accurate, and comprehensive information and selected cultural expressions for the benefit of and at the service of our democracy. But that may be easier said than done at times. In fact, it wasn't even easy for me to read it. For this week's Please Explain, I'm joined by Alicia C. Shepard, NPR's ombudsman, to explain how NPR attempts to fulfill its ambitious mission and what it does when it falls short. And I'm very pleased to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you.
Last time you were here was to discuss your book about Woodward and Bernstein. How long after that did you become NPR's ombudsman?
I started the job in October, so I'm pretty new at it, and I'm still trying to figure out the best way to do it. But basically, the job as I see it is to explain NPR to the listeners and the listeners to NPR.
Mm-hmm. But you also have to talk to the people at NPR if there is an issue that comes up, the same as the person at the New York Times,
right,
who has to figure out whether the listener or the reader is correct on a certain thing or whether NPR did the right thing.
Oh, yeah. That's what I meant by explain the listeners to NPR, because I will go to NPR and say, what happened in this case? Tell me about the thought process, and you know, here's some of the criticism I'm hearing. And at the end of the day, I'm in a difficult position in the sense that I work for NPR, I'm paid by NPR, and yet I am sometimes publicly critical of NPR. And so at the end of the day, I would hope that anyone in NPR would say, well, I didn't like what she wrote, or I didn't like what she said, but she was fair.
Before this, you were a journalist, an educator, an author. Mm-hmm. Would a journalist have more sympathy for the problems faced by fellow journalists than someone outside of the profession?
I think that a journalist will better understand how the profession works, and I think that's why I'm good for this job, because I have in some ways just been a professional media critic for the last 15 years. I spent 10 writing for a magazine called American Journalism Review, which is a trade publication for journalists, and I would write about ethical lapses and explanatory pieces. And so I am really a big champion of a free press. I feel that we are very fortunate in this country to have that. And so I'll be a champion of good journalism, not necessarily just NPR's journalism.
Well, there was a time when newspapers and radio stations and radio networks didn't feel the need to have an ombudsman. When did NPR come up with its first ombudsman?
Kevin Close, the president of NPR, created the position in 2000. And he was very much influenced by having worked at the Washington Post for 25 years. And the Washington Post has had an ombudsman, you know, back into the early 70s. I think it's definitely a critical role because it's keeping an eye on the watchdog. And it's a credit to any news organization that has one. ESPN has an ombudsman. Public broadcasting has an ombudsman, but mostly it is a position in the news world for newspapers. And what's happening now is the budgets are shrinking at many newspapers. It's an easy position to get rid of and have that person fill some more a function of putting out the newspaper every day. So I think it's really to NPR's credit that they have this position.
Well, NPR is doing better than ever, better than most newspapers. Maybe they should hire another ombudsman just to reflect that. Is that because of the Kroc Endowment, or is it just because public radio is, at this point, is booming, as the New York Times pointed out recently?
Right. It is the Kroc money. It was $236 million that I was given, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. And right away, NPR had $50 million to spend opening up new bureaus, improving their audio equipment, and just that's a tremendous, I'm sure WNYC would love to have that sudden influx of money.
I'd like to have it myself.
Yes, yes. But they
direct
also
deposit.
The the Kroc money, which comes from the McDonald's family, limited what about 100, 200 million of it can't be touched right away. So that gives them a comfortable cushion to know that every year they have that, they don't have to worry about, you know, how are we going to make it for the next year.
Do you have specific journalistic standards to abide by, or are you pretty much reacting to your sense of what journalism is on a gut level, on your own personal theoretical level?
NPR has a code of ethics, so that right away gives me marching orders.
Would that be similar to what we'd see at the Times and the Washington Post? So,
yes, and you know, there are pretty much four standards or tenets of any good ethics code, which is seek truth and report it, minimize harm, be accountable, and act independently. And then within that are, you know, different itemizations depending on the medium. But NPR's ethics code is probably not much different than any other good news organization that has an ethics code. And then to just take it one step further, as somebody who, as a journalism professor, has been writing about the media, who cares deeply about it, I know what good journalism is, and I know what the standards are, and I know when the corners are cut. And so I'd like to think that I can also be proactive. If I see something that I think is a potential conflict or shouldn't be happening at NPR, I can write about it. I have a weekly column, npr.org/ombudsman. And
do people write to you there?
Yes. You can go to npr.org and the Contact Us button and ask me any question, or if any of your listeners have a particular complaint about NPR coverage, they can also call 202-513-3245. That's 202-513-3245. Sounds like I'm advertising for something, but I'm just offering the phone number or email as a way of contacting the ombudsman at NPR.
Well, you also can contact Lisa now by calling us at 212-433-9692. We'll be taking your calls in a little while. So a listener submits a comment or a complaint to your office. Do you review each message?
No, I can't. I have a part-time assistant who goes through all of the emails, and she has been doing it for about a year, so she knows what would rise to the level of something that I should take an interest in. All emails are responded to, but sometimes it will just be thank you for taking the time to write. NPR has 26 million listeners. We value your opinion. And that's to say that it was read.
Sometimes, in fact, all too often, I get messages, emails from people who misheard what was said on the air. And I don't know what to do. I usually respond to them more than to the person who says, you are crazy, you are awful, mm-hmm. you should die.
Right, yeah. The other thing,
I get too many of those as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, NPR is a news network. And so I do get a lot of emails that will say, why are you giving so much coverage to Obama and you're not giving Hillary Clinton equal time? And I have
or vice versa.
Or exactly. But I need to remind the listeners that they don't listen to all of NPR's 50 hours of original programming each week. And people listen to radio, as you know, in a different way than they read the newspaper. No one sits in front of a radio and just listens. I mean, they dip in and out of it. They listen as they're making dinner or they're getting ready in the morning. So the coverage is, in every way, I think NPR attempts to be thorough and accurate and fair and balanced, and those are very important values. But just because you didn't hear it doesn't mean it wasn't on there.
Or you misheard it. I had just an instance today. I got a letter from somebody who said, you said that, in this case, it was psychotherapy is an American thing. I was talking about in treatment.
Right.
But I had actually said, it's interesting that this is Israeli and American. I was speaking to Gabriel Byrne, who's European. I was asking about European attitudes towards psychotherapy. And the listener, who was an Israeli psychotherapist, heard that I'd said it was just American. And he was outraged.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know what to do with that, because it was a nice letter. He's a listener at the same time. he misheard.
Right.
And people do often just for one reason or another, or maybe I'm not always as clear as I could be. Mm-hmm. If you do make an error of fact, where are the corrections posted? I don't mean you. I mean right. somebody at NPR.
That is an excellent question. And I feel very strongly that for the news media to become more credible and have people believe more in how valuable the news media is, that they need to be more transparent and they need to admit that they make mistakes. We all make mistakes as human beings. And in the news business, you're operating under tremendous pressure and time constraints. And I don't know any journalist that I've ever met or known who would say, you know, I think I'm going to make a mistake today, or I'm going to intentionally, you know, put in a wrong fact. However, corrections just don't seem to be enough a part of the DNA of a newsroom. Often newsrooms are defensive and they don't want to acknowledge that they made mistakes. The very first column that I wrote as an ombudsman basically said, sometime today, NPR most likely made a mistake on the air, and that, you know, to enhance the credibility, you need to acknowledge the mistake, be public about it.
Should you do it on the air?
Well, that is the dilemma that all broadcast outlets face, because you might have made a mistake yesterday and a listener heard it and thought, you know, whoa, you got that wrong. And then the next day you might correct it and the listeners, you know, at a parent-teacher conference and didn't hear it. So I think that you have to do that, but you also, because we have the advantage of the internet and it can be a supplement, a complement to the what's on air, I think that NPR needs to have or do better with its corrections page. There's npr.org/corrections. And I checked yesterday, I think the last mistake that was made was March 12th.
Suspect there have been a few since.
Yes.
Does NPR see itself as part of the so-called mainstream media? Listeners will tell you, of course, that NPR is far to the left of the rest of the American press. But do you see it that way?
Well, first, I want
to... And I kind of know the answer
advance. I wanted to say that... NPR, like any outlet, does a lot of audience research, and that the latest, and this is independent research, i.e. having somebody outside of NPR, and 30% of the listeners consider themselves conservative, 30%, 28% liberal, and 24% middle of the road. So the it is definitely true that probably since 2000, and because as NPR has grown, it has become more mainstream. It was more of an alternative news source. And then as, you know, right now their listenership, their total of about 25.5 million listeners with all the five shows. So their political coverage, I just spoke about a month ago with the political editor and asked him, you know, why aren't you covering Ron Paul more, or how do you make the decisions? And he said he felt that he'd been given a mandate to be more on record.
There is a problem along those lines. People have criticized not just NPR, but everyone for giving less attention to Ron Paul or Bill Richardson or Joe Biden or Dennis Kucinich, because there is this tendency to follow the narrative. And mm-hmm. the narratives right now are the horse race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and the John McCain comeback.
Right. It's hard to dispute that. And I think that all news organizations need to do better. I think as Americans, we need to get as much information as possible to make an informed decision about who you want to vote for. One of the columns that I wrote was about, is NPR ignoring Ron Paul? Ron Paul was quite a phenomenon. And one day he raised $6 million. You drive around where I live in Arlington, Virginia, there are lots of Ron Paul signs. Somebody's learning about Ron Paul. Someone's sending him money. If the news media is setting the agenda and saying, well, you know, Ron Paul doesn't have a chance, so we're not going to air his views, how is that widening the way that listeners get information.
Well, it seems to me that may be part of the appeal of a Ron Paul, that they feel that there's a conspiracy. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out
there.
Well, we have a number of listener comments that come in, and some wonder about underwriters' influence of NPR's coverage, for mm-hmm. example. And I'm sure you deal with that quite a bit.
Yes. In fact, that is something that I probably in the next couple of weeks we'll look into, because we had an interesting discussion. NPR has a bureau here in New York City. I met with the staff there yesterday, and they were, some of the reporters there feel that they shouldn't know who the funders are, who the corporate underwriters are, that it might influence them. And then others say that sometimes what happens is they'll maybe be writing a story, or they'll be airing a story about a science issue, and they will have spoken to the Union of Concerned Scientists, and then there'll be a funding credit from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And so to the average listener, that sounds like pay for play.
We've had that experience with talking about certain films,
mm-hmm,
and
yes.
then we have an underwriting announcement. On the other hand, when I first started here, the major underwriter was Colt Industries, and we did a lot of shows.
Those are guns, right?
Yes. Makers of wonderful firearms since 1872, or whatever we used
right.
to say. And then we would do something on gun control.
Uh-huh.
My feeling was, that was that, and this is this, and I suspect most journalists feel that way.
Journalists do, but journalists understand how things work and that there is a firewall. The public doesn't. And so they are confused, and they think, well, gee, you know, you're doing that story because Colt is funding you.
Well, let's talk about a few of the things that people have written in to us before we start taking calls. Our number, by the way, is 212-433-9692. One listener left a comment on our show page criticizing NPR for using President Bush's chosen phrase, global war on terror, because the listener says it's a fraudulent spin, because you can't fight a war in a tactic like the war on drugs. How do you respond to that?
But you can't find.
Well, the point is that they're saying that somebody else comes up with a phrase,
right?
Whether it's that, the global war on terror, whether it's right to life or whatever, and then everybody just uses it, whether that is the most accurate phrase
right.
or not.
And I think that every day in newsrooms there should be questions of, should we be using this? And we just talked with the WNYC staff about Hamas. Is Hamas a terrorist organization, or is it a organization that the United States considers a terrorist organization? So I can only say that you have to keep challenging your own assumptions.
And the Middle East is where we got any number of comments. One said he's disappointed in NPR's reporting on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He says Arab soldiers are referred to as militants, while Israeli soldiers are referred to as Israelis. And then on the other hand, we have gotten many complaints about a perceived pro-Palestinian bias on NPR, to the point where people have written in about organizing boycotts against NPR stations.
That NPR is pro-Palestinian is
yeah.
the question. I would only encourage listeners to look at the totality of the coverage. That I think last week there was a piece about a Palestinian plumber, and it was talking about how difficult his life was and how long it took him to get to work. And it was a slice of life of what it was like. But there are also stories about how difficult life is for Israelis. And NPR is so concerned about this that they set up a special Middle East page. Normally, listeners have to pay for transcripts, but with this Middle East page, you can get any transcripts you want for free. And the only way that NPR has determined to deal with these perceptions, depending on who they come from, of unfair coverage, is to put it all out there and try to be as transparent as possible.
There are some listeners wrote in that NPR echoes the spin initiated by government officials, especially in times of real national crisis, like the run-up to the war in Iraq. Some listeners even object to the phrase Iraq War. They think that it should have been changed to the Iraq occupation ever since President Bush made his mission accomplished speech. Do people agonize over whether it's this phrase or not, or do you just
absolutely.
Simply say what everybody else is saying?
No. In fact, I'm often asked, you know, why are you using Hamas? Should you use terrorists? What about, do you say anti-immigrant, anti-illegal immigrant? All of these issues are very important to different spheres of people, and language is very loaded. And that's why I think it's really important that journalists continue to challenge their assumptions. We joked before about, remember, strongman, Panamanian strongman Noriega. And you just, like, that becomes a phrase without even thinking about what does that mean.
So when would NPR go against the mainstream media and start calling Iraq an occupation rather than a war?
I don't know. I mean, I'd have to talk to the editors, and I don't think I could answer that question. I could certainly, you know, raise it. I mean, as the ombudsman, again, I am independent, and people will say, well, how can you be independent if NPR is paying your salary? And I would answer that I have a 2-year employment contract. And so that speaks to giving me some freedom.
People can complain to you, but they can't change what you write.
They can't change what I write, but I can also not say you should not use Hamas as a terrorist organization, or you should use Hamas as a terrorist.
Alicia Shepard is the NPR ombudsman, and she is our guest today on Please Explain. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Alicia Shepard, who is NPR's ombudsman, and she is our guest today on Please Explain here on WNYC, WNYC.org. Dennis from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Alicia and Leonard. I'm calling about the total blackout of coverage of the Winter Soldiers meeting last week. Veterans against the Iraq War came out and gave testimony of harrowing atrocities that they had themselves participated in or witnessed. And there was no coverage anywhere, including, with the minor exception, I think, of All Things Considered, doing a little piece of this incredible testimony, which was visual. And obviously, this won't apply to you, but I mean, it was so compelling, dramatic, emotional, powerful testimony, and it was just totally ignored. And it's so important because these people were on the ground. They're there, and they're not, you know, jetting in and jetting out. They saw what was happening and how the Iraqi people are very much against their occupation there.
And so I guess the question is, and it's not just that, but because people do become suspicious, why is one story covered and not another story when this other story seems to be just as important or maybe even more important?
Yeah, Dennis, I would ask you to send me an email at NPR.org, contact us, and if you go to the bottom, it's the ombudsman, because I know that my assistant mentioned that we'd gotten a bunch of emails about that, and I've, you know, been out of town, so I don't know exactly what NPR's coverage was on this, but I do know that there are other people who are interested, and I'd only ask you to maybe go to NPR.org and search the website and see. It may be, as you said, that only All Things Considered, and your question is obviously, well, where was the rest of the media as well? I mean, did the Washington Post cover it? Did the New York Times? Did NBC? Did WNYC? Sometimes I think it's a matter of it may have been covered and it didn't get the prominence that you would have liked. Or
we have had the, I'm not saying this happened in this case, but we have had any number of times the experience of having listeners say, well, you ignored the story. And we say, well, we didn't ignore the story. You just missed that segment. We can't talk about everything all day long at the same time.
Yeah.
We go now to Claudia from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Something I've consistently wondered about is why NPR uses the term pro-life as opposed to anti-abortion. If you listen to the NewsHour, for example, or the New York Times, they don't co-opt the language of the people who are opposed to choice. And I feel it's a very biased term. The only people I know who are not pro-life are terrorists. I'm pro-life, but I'm strongly pro-choice.
Right. I feel that I wish I had the answer here, because I know that NPR has really struggled with that issue, and in particular, Julie Rovner, who's the health correspondent and does these kind of issues. And I'm not sure that that you're totally accurate, but you know that they always say pro-life, because I know that this is a particular issue. And again, if you contact me, you can call 202-513-3245, and I'll look into that. It might be worth my writing about and seeing if that's really is the case. And I totally agree with you that pro-life, using just that expression, eliminates all the people who are pro-choice.
Okay, Claudia.
Thank you.
Thank you. Richard from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. My original question was about Merck, and I'd like to follow up with a more general question. When the reports were first coming out about the problems with, I think it was Vioxx, very shortly after that, all of a sudden, NPR was inundated with sponsorships by Merck Corporation.
Do you think it affected the coverage of the story?
I think it had to. I mean, human beings are human beings. They know where, their food is coming from.
I have to tell you this. I know people. I'm going to defend NPR here because I have to defend myself.
Sure.
I have never, not once, ever changed anything on this show because somebody was an underwriter. I ignore what the who the underwriters are. I don't care. I just try to do the best radio show that I can.
Well,
this may not be true in other cases. I know of newspapers that have suffered because they ran a story and then a major advertiser
pulled out.
But, you know, we rely on so many different ways of getting money, including listener support, that I don't think any one underwriter could really, well, sure wouldn't influence me.
Mm-hmm.
But you must hear a lot about this, Lisa, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Walmart, and also, people were upset that Walmart started underwriting because so many people see Walmart as the antithesis of everything NPR stands for.
Right. And people sometimes talk to me about, oh, NPR has become much more commercial. And interestingly, I asked the people who do corporate sponsorship, is that true? Are you reaching out for a more commercial audience? And they said, actually, it's just the opposite, that as NPR has grown into a bigger audience and, you know, reaches, you know, 25 to 30 million people, big corporations want to appear on NPR. And just, you know, to explain once again to your listener that there is this firewall between the people who raise money or who get corporate sponsorships or go to foundations and ask for money. Those people work in a separate building, and they have really no influence on how news is decided. And that's true in no matter what the medium.
Well, the only time we ever got any pressure was when we were still owned by New York City, and sometimes the mayor's office would call in and say, I was unhappy that you did that. We still ignored it.
Sure.
Because we have responsibilities to our audience.
Absolutely. It would be crazy for you to cave like that. You would be hurting your own credibility. And that's the thing to think about. If NPR changed their coverage because Merck was giving them money, why would they be believable?
A listener left a comment on our show page wanting to know why NPR has insisted that stations upgrade to HD radio when most people don't listen to it.
Now, I'm not a technical person, but the decision to move to HD would be a local station decision. NPR is nothing more than programming, and it's programming that a public radio station would decide if they want to purchase NPR, they want to purchase independent produced shows or NPR distributed shows. So I don't think that NPR is insisting, and I think that stations see HD as a way to offer their listeners more programming.
Here's a caller whose name I'm not sure I can pronounce. Is it Tai?
Yes, Tai, yes.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
What's your question or your comment?
My comment is something I've observed and I found like incredibly disturbing, and it's only with the NPR coverage, not so much the WN, not at all, in fact, WNYC. But I've noticed with people like Andrea Seabrook, and I think it's Brooke Gladstone, and some of the weekend edition coverage, that they adopt this kind of bizarre lilting quality, regardless of the content of what they're discussing. So even if it's something incredibly tragic or serious or grave, it's like as if they're talking to, you know, retarded nursery school children or something. And I've just found that deeply offensive and antithetical, really, to, you know, what the what is usually one usually associates with public radio.
Lisa, I have to do a follow-up before you answer. Most of those people do work for NPR, but at least one of the names cited does not work for WNYC. And NPR does distribute shows from all over the country. How responsible are you as an ombudsman for shows that are produced by WNYC or WBUR or one of the Chicago stations or someone in L.A.?
That is a fascinating question. NPR does five shows that it produces with original content, and then it distributes Car Talk and On the Media, as you mentioned, and a whole host of other shows. And in each case, there is a contract, and those shows are supposed to uphold the NPR ethics code. But what is done about it is unclear.
But in this listener's concern is that people have tone. Can you is that something an ombudsman can get involved with? Can you sound a little less bubbly, please?
Right. I can pass on these any kinds of criticisms about the host, which I do, and I send them to the vice president of programming just to let them know this is what some people think about a particular host.
A listener left a comment on our show page saying it's time for a national code of professional responsibility and a code of ethics for the news media. Would you like to see something like that?
Well, I think that there already is something like that. As I mentioned, the Society of Professional Journalists has the ethics code I talked about at the beginning of the hour. Every news organization has an ethics code. So I have a feeling, unless the listener, that they're talking about something different than a code of ethics.
Well, perhaps they're talking about the fact that there are obviously biases that you can perceive all across the media, whether you're looking at the tabloids or whether you're looking at certain services on cable television, even some of the news shows, the national news shows. And perhaps if somebody came up with a basic set of rules that everybody had to abide by, we wouldn't see those biases displayed.
Well, one of the things that I've learned in the short time that I've been with NPR is that bias is in the perception of the listener. And so I could listen to that story I mentioned that Eric Westerfeld did about the plumber, the Palestinian plumber. And if I live there, I might have a tremendous empathy and think that that's a great story. I'm glad it's out there. If, you know, I'm very pro-Israeli and think, wow, you're not writing enough about what the Palestinians are doing to the Israeli, then I'm going to hear that story in a different way. So bias is really, really a difficult issue.
But every journalist I've spoken to have said objectivity is an impossibility.
Of course, yes. And you just want to do the best we can. Exactly.
And we have run out of time, alas.
Oh, boy. Well, I'll be happy to come back, and I'm sure there'll be more questions.
I would love to have you back.
And again, npr.org/ombudsman, and all the contact information will be there.
And we've been talking with Alicia Shepard, who is NPR's ombudsman, on today's Please Explain.